Hello, and welcome to Bright Lights Big Data, a podcast about people, places, and data. I'm your data host, Tammy Armstrong.
I'm your planning host, Mike Armstrong.
And we are very excited to have here with us today, Tess Cody from ACCESS, which stands for, I have this pulled up, Assault Care Center Extending Shelter and Support. Mm-hmm. So Tess, thank you for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We did this last year and we were excited to do it again this year, that for the month of December, we'll do a Give Local series featuring different local nonprofits for every episode of the month in December. So since this is airing on Monday, December 2nd, we're excited to have Tess here from ACCESS to tell us all about the good work that they do in the community. So without further ado, question number one, what do you do with ACCESS and how did you get there?
Yeah, sometimes it's helpful to give a little, the name is so long, so sometimes a little quick summary of what it is. I'm the director of ACCESS, which is an anti-violence organization that serves five counties, kind of just north of the metro. We have Ames as our main base, but also work in Marshalltown and a couple other places that people might be very familiar with. The agency does work in the arenas of domestic violence, sexual assault, homicide, and other violent crimes. And we provide a big range of support services that includes something like helping people navigate kind of complex systems that after somebody's been hurt, they might kind of interface with. So it's like going to the hospital, reporting to the police, or figuring out like, hey, my kid needs to go to school, but I'm not living in the same place. How does that work? You know, so it's a lot of that figuring things out. We help people in that way. We run an emergency shelter, but we also do a lot of community programming. So education work, kind of trying to focus on stopping violence before it starts.
Yeah, yeah.
So kind of that big collective. I started a long time ago. So I, right out of college, worked for a shelter actually over in Cedar Rapids, and then transitioned to work for a state-level version of the Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, and then have just worked for the last 11 years at other kind of anti-violence organizations doing similar work. My heart is definitely in prevention work, so that kind of education and systems, not navigation, but engaging systems to help them change and get better, whether that is getting better at responding to people who come forward and say, hey, I've got this traumatic experience and I now need to interface with you, or get better at making sure that they themselves aren't abusive as well. So those are kind of that kind of systems level work is where my heart is.
That's great.
Yeah. So I've been doing that for a while. Joined ACCESS 2 years ago and have been really excited to do. My job tends to be the admin paper pushing side, but those are really important sides. But I also work with all of our teams to help make sure that they have what they need, that they've got the vision that they need to support the survivors they serve.
Great. And what was your education background? What does someone do to get into this kind of work?
You know, you can come in many, many different paths. We've got folks on our staff who have an associate's in some sort of human service-y sort of field. We have folks on our staff who have their bachelor's. And again, lots of folks in like a criminal justice, human service. But we also have some folks who have like a biology degree. So it's a pretty pretty open-ended field in that way. And then we have other folks, myself included, who have their master's. So I have mine in public administration, which kind of fits with, you know, that the system paperwork side and the system side of things. So lots of ways people get here. We also have folks who don't necessarily have higher ed, but have a lot of work experience. And so the great thing about this field is it's definitely one where it takes a lot of skill set, a lot of different types of people to do the work collectively. And so because of that, we can really welcome a lot of people to the team.
That's great.
Yeah. So question two, what are some common misconceptions about your work?
I think a big one is, especially when you talk about domestic abuse or sexual assault, you'll often kind of get lots of questions like, why do they stay? Questions about that. Also, it's funny, they also start often from a defensive place of, well, you know, men can be abused too. And so then there's a lot of questions about, do you serve men? So there's a lot of, I think, preconceived notions about who we serve and why we serve them. And so that's kind of the stuff I like to tackle. So people get into relationships, just kind of tackle the first one about like, why do they stay or do they like it? You'll sometimes hear that. It sounds like a funny thing, but you might see like, well, that's just the way their relationship is, or that's just the way they are. And that's complicated.
Yeah.
So those two to me are kind of intertwined, but I don't know about you, but any relationship I've ever gotten into, it's because I, you know, thought someone looked cute, and so you fall in love with people because you fall in love with people. You go on a date with someone because you're excited about them, you know? Yeah. Most people are like that. I haven't met a survivor yet who didn't have a very similar sort of rationale for that. And what happens is they get into those positions and somebody betrays their trust or uses that relationship and that status against them and kind of gets them locked in there. You know, it's a lot of manipulation, misrepresentation, things like that that happen. So people fall in love because they fall in love. And oftentimes when we talk about this genre of crimes, it's somebody that you know and trust, and you have time of grooming that will make it so things, they just slowly become a big deal.
Right.
And they kind of sneak up on you. You don't like to start with somebody punching you in the face. You know, you start with...
Yeah, that first date doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's one of those, like, from our side, kind of outside the field, we see this more in terms of, like, how media deals with the fallout or how, those sorts of stories. And whether it's this type of issue or something else, it doesn't seem like as a culture we do very well at supporting and understanding victims. Like we're not comfortable with the idea of being a victim.
Yeah.
And so we look for ways out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a whole kind of mythos, right? Built up around, gosh, you know, especially it's probably the most clear to me in cases of sexual assault where you talk about like, oh, what were they wearing? Should they have been at that party? Yes. Should they have been that drunk? Mm-hmm. All of that is actually a narrative as a community of fear, right? And if I come up with all the reasons why that might have happened, all the theories on why that might have happened, well, if I don't do those things, then I'll be safe and it won't happen to me. When in reality, if somebody wants to hurt you, and this sounds really bleak, I know it, but if somebody wants to hurt you, they will. These are crimes of opportunity. These are crimes where somebody is making a choice to target somebody else. And so there are things that are that you can like reasonably make yourself slightly safer, but it's also something where when we talk about domestic abuse, sexual abuse, and even other kinds of violence. So, you know, we do work with homicide survivors, robbery, assault, a variety. They're often people you know. They're people you're close to. And so, you know, it's awfully tough. You can keep pointing to all those things, but in reality, you might just be hurting people around you for and need to have more empathy if they come to you, and you need to be caring to yourself if it happens to you. And so using those to explain it away might not actually be that helpful as a community.
Yeah, we see that in my field for automobile crashes. Especially when it's with a group that some people think are making themselves more vulnerable. So people walking or people biking, and it's like, this person got hit by a semi-truck, and they will ask, were they wearing a helmet? And it's like, that's not going to do much, even if they were. But they're just looking for ways to make it feel more controllable and understandable and predictable.
Were they so covered head to toe in flashing lights?
Yeah. Because nobody likes to hear, like, it can happen, and it could happen to anybody.
I could talk to you all day about some of those things. Because I think that, to the point, like there's so many things about violence that people don't understand because it's scary. And so unpacking any of those questions, the why do they stay, why do they, all of those, happy to dig into more, but also know that you don't have all day.
And it's sort of interesting, like, you know, it's part of the social problem and the structural problem behind these issues is that they don't get talked about. And so unless you're actively seeking it out or you have somebody kind of in your inner circle, like over the past year or two, I've had more women in my kind of social network who are passionate about abuse issues and sexual violence and things like that. And so hearing their stories and seeing them share things and understanding a little bit more about how, like, what can initially appear like romance and someone taking care of you is them actually taking away your agency and setting it up so that you can't leave when they do start to reveal their violent tendencies and the serial abusers, and just this financial abuse was not something I was ever aware of until I saw someone talk about it on a mom's group that I'm a part of, that the dad was cutting up the daughter's new shoes. So it's hurting the child. She can't go to school in her new shoes. And now it's expected that the mother is going to replace them. And that's money that she has to spend. I mean, just, it really is eye-opening, but we don't talk about it. And that makes it, I'm sure, that much harder when you are someone in that situation thinking, it's my fault because this doesn't just happen.
Well, it's partially about thinking it's my fault. And it's also, you know, I would even say this of myself. There have been times where it's like, gosh, you know, I didn't even recognize that was abuse. And so, you know, crap, why did it take me years to get out of this relationship? It's because I didn't necessarily know those things were wrong, because we don't, I don't know about you all, but in growing up, we didn't have a lot of clear conversations about what's consent.
Right.
What is good sex? What's a healthy relationship? Those were kind of taboo topics. Mm-hmm. And so if it wasn't my friends kind of like gossiping about it, I didn't actually have a lot of productive things other than like, here's what an STD is. Mm-hmm. That's not actually getting to the kind of social ramifications of how do I navigate this situation and who are these people? You know, that was missing for me. And I think it's missing for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes all you have to go on is, well, that didn't feel very good, but is that abuse? And really starting to unpack that over time. Financial abuse is a great example of one of those where it's like, well, it's not the same thing as, you know, being beat up, right? But could it also be really detrimental to you? Could it have emotional impacts? Absolutely. Could it be tied then into building up to something that's more physical? It's complicated. But I think some of it's that silence also means I don't even necessarily know when I get to call it that.
Yeah. All right. So question number three, why should the community care about what you do?
I think they should care about it for lots and lots of reasons. One, I think just even remembering that this is a big issue. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes because it gets really hidden, people don't recognize the scale. And, you know, you love data, so we could throw out lots of stats, right? You know, 1 in 6 will experience sexual assault. I think that stat might actually be for cis women. It's like 1 in 2 for the trans community. I mean, it's like there's some pretty big, scary numbers out there. I think sometimes data in this arena loses the compelling part of it. Mm-hmm. And so just remembering, like, these are people you know who've experienced this at some point in their lifetime. And not only is it a crime that happens really frequently here in central Iowa, probably in your family friend circle, but it's also something that's really hard to heal from for some folks. Some folks, they've got the support system that they need, and there are others that don't. And so I think people should care because we can be that system that helps make recovery easier. I wish I could remember the stat off the top of my head, but it's something like within the first couple people that you disclose to, their response to you really kind of determines the path for your healing. And so when a survivor comes to a friend and discloses and they get that whole narrative of like, oh, well, you know, did you say something to tip off their temper? Were you drinking? That kind of questioning, then they question themselves and they start to feel like people don't trust them or don't believe them. They can't turn to people. So it can make that healing process just longer or harder. Whereas if they heard from somebody the opposite, the community said, hey, I got you, I'm sorry, that's a way more affirming message. And again, it starts somebody on a different trajectory. And we, I think, can say that interpersonally with our friends, our family. But I also think that we can make decisions as a community about what resources we want available, how we want them to be available, that sends that same message. Whether that's, I expect a school system to actually be responsive and be willing to move a kid to a new classroom if they're sitting right behind the person who hurt them in math class, or whether that's having advocates like our agency financially supported so that they can show up at the hospital at 2 a.m. What do we want to have available to support people and be affirming, I think is really important.
something that was really interesting to me was, I don't know if you've ever seen the show Broadchurch.
Mm-hmm. I love that show.
So good. I started watching it because I love David Tennant, and then I just got totally sucked in. And I think it was the latest season, at least the third season, is about a sexual assault survivor and following her case. And one of the things that really struck me is, you know, and this is set in the UK, is that the moment she went to the police, they brought in a specialist mm-hmm. that is part of, I don't know if they're on payroll for the police or it was an advocate that they partner with, but somebody to basically serve in that role and help understand and help be there almost like a doula in childbirth, like taking you through this process and yep. being supportive and helping you understand what you need to be thinking about. And just somebody who focuses on that. The entire narrative was about the police believing mm-hmm. the report and believing the reporter. And it was just so shockingly different to everything we hear over the news about what happened stateside. And I just thought it was a really interesting image of like what it could be like.
Yeah, you know, and what's interesting there, so in Iowa, and Iowa is different, every state has their structures a little bit different, but in Iowa, we have agencies like ours that have something, we call them crime victim advocates. There's a couple mm-hmm. other phrases you might hear out there. They're confidential, and you actually have a right to have them throughout a criminal justice process, and so we're also, so that confidential, and we can come with you to make a police report. We can be there if that eventually goes to trial and you get deposed. We can be in, sit in on the deposition. So it's that's in that great. Way there's yeah. a person who can kind of follow mm-hmm. you. What I actually really like about the system we have is it's separate from the police department in part because that means our services can also go to other systems where if we were just located in a police department, you'd really only be criminally justice focused. And the vast majority of victims and survivors don't actually go to the police. And so it's like, how do you serve, you know, the 95% versus just the 5%?
Yeah.
Our job as victims advocates is to help that process be focused on your healing and justice when it's not necessarily actually designed for everybody to achieve both of those things. Yeah. And the police's job it is to keep the community safe. Also sometimes justice, right? That's where we kind of overlap. And we also care about safety. So again, overlap. Yeah. There's tons of like shared values, but there is some difference, right? Their job is to kind of be committed to this system. There's been a lot of push in Iowa to, again, take that approach of starting by believing, or at least I always that start by believing people kind of feel like, oh, the balances of justice, they get worried about that. But just remembering it's really about like taking people seriously is kind of another way to phrase it, I think. There's a lot of push for that and a lot of training of law enforcement, work in progress, but a lot of training. But that's what our agency is all about, is being that person who can be that neutral person who's there for you as a survivor and who can kind of follow you through the whole process.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, police deal with so many different kinds of things in their world. And yeah, if you're a survivor and you're going through, that's a really significant moment in your life. I think, yeah, absolutely. I would want someone that's what they do, being an empathetic and caring and expert partner through that.
Yeah. And can see you, the whole person, you know, kind of like the doula you mentioned, they kind of get to see they don't just focus on this one little piece. They focus on this bigger piece. So, you know, our agency can help with things like, do you have transportation to get to the police to make the report? Do you want to apply for crime victim compensation? So that way, if you have to miss work, that we can make sure you kind of get those wages made up. You know, some of those things that police might care that you get all those things and want those things for you, but that's just not their role, not their job.
Yeah.
And so this is the person who kind of helps make sure all those other pieces are getting met.
Well, and you've already mentioned several things I didn't even know existed at all, let alone in Iowa. So yeah, having those educated resources to make sure that you are getting everything you need is great.
All right. On an up note, question 4, what are you most excited about right now?
Oh, most excited about in work or just in general? So I would say at Access, we have kind of been working really hard to shore up some stuff. You know, we had some turnover, nonprofit life, right? But I feel always excited about when I see parts of our programs really kind of hit their stride. And one of our programs that I think is getting there is our housing program. So we're a really special agency in the state when it comes to how we provide emergency housing services. Most have this kind of big shelter, like here in Des Moines, CFI has something like 60 beds, one big space for the most part. They have some other kind of scattered housing, but for the most part, their emergency shelter is one location, lots and lots of beds in that spot, staff 24/7. Ours isn't like that. Ours actually looks like a series of apartments. And so it's something like one family might occupy an entire unit, so you might not be sharing with a whole bunch of people, which is so different than communal living. Because who can think back to college and say communal living kind of stinks?
Yeah.
But series of apartments. It's also in multiple locations. So we have some in Ames, some over one unit over in Marshalltown. And ours is not staffed 24/7. So clients get a key to the front door and they come and go as they want. So there's not like a curfew sort of situation. What I love about that approach is there's a lot of dignity in it. These are adults, you know, doing their adult life.
Feels less institutional maybe too.
It does. It feels less institutional. I think also about kids. So a lot of the folks that we serve are survivors who come into our emergency shelter with their children. Mm-hmm. And when I think about disrupting a child's life as someone flees, if a parent is just bringing their child to what feels like their new apartment, that feels way less scary, way less traumatic in and of itself than bringing it to this large communal living space with a bunch of other traumatized people. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's really good outcomes for kids in that respect. The other thing I really kind of like about the model is folks always stay pretty independent. And so there's not like a we serve dinner at 5 p.m.
Yeah.
You never kind of get into that rhythm. And so people just kind of, I think, have the potential to just keep their momentum. Mm-hmm. They made this brave choice of leaving. And now how do I keep my momentum to move on to where I have my own stable space? And it works really well for a lot of safety reasons. People kind of get worried about that. Like, what? It's not staffed. Who's barricading the door? but really having multiple apartment units means that we can put somebody in one place. And if they got found, we have the ability to just move them to an entirely different location.
Yeah.
When you only have one facility, you don't get that kind of anonymity. Mm-hmm. We have, you know, security cameras and all of those. We have locks, but people get to control their own security, their own safety. And I think that's really important. When we went to that model, we actually did a whole bunch of surveys and interviews with past clients to help us design a housing model. And the two things that really rose to the top for them was they wanted to prioritize having control over their own safety and be able to make their own decisions. And then the other one was they wanted to not have to parent in public constantly. Mm. When you're in a large-scale shelter, you're constantly parenting in public. And that's hard.
Yeah.
Best case scenarios, it's still stressful.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Let alone now there's all these rules about, like, you can't leave your kid in the living room by themselves. Who doesn't leave their kid in the living room sometimes, right? You know? It's just tricky. So this model lets them control both of those things. So that's great. We have not had more issues with security than we did when we used to be a big one-stop shop kind of shelter. So that's a success.
Yeah.
I'm excited about that. We, like I mentioned, we've had a little staff turnover. And so when we've been short-staffed, we've had to kind of reduce the number of beds we had open just because you actually have to have a case manager. Some of that sort of stuff is just, there's some practical side to that. Wanting to make sure we can actually safely house people, not by being too understaffed. So in those times, our average length of stay has gone up. But whenever we're fully staffed, our average length of stay is actually quite low. And so we're under that 30-day when we're fully staffed. We're over when we are understaffed. That's not shocking. But we've had that model 4 years, something like that, right in that ballpark. And I just feel like we're kind of at a moment where we're really starting to hit our stride, especially our unit that we have in Marshalltown. So what's really hard about that is it's operated remotely, the staff office in Ames. And I feel like we've really started to figure out a lot of the, how do you operate a shelter in a city that you don't live in? And so I'm excited about that. I think there's a lot of potential for the model to work and to work in a way that allows agencies like ours to provide emergency shelter in the places people actually live, so they don't have to uproot their entire their system of support, right. You know, their friends, all that, just to be safe. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really excited about that. I feel like, you know, time will tell, you know, hopefully the wheels don't fall off in the next couple of years. But I think there's so much potential for it to do a lot of good that I'm excited to keep watching it evolve and hopefully strengthen.
That's great. Yeah.
So this is part of our December nonprofit series. Yep. How can individuals best support your work or your organization?
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure you'll hear this from most of the nonprofits, but charitable giving is a really important thing. And for agencies like ours, especially certain things like our shelter program it's funded in part by a local grant making agency in Ames, but it's also largely funded by individual giving. And mm-hmm. so making a financial gift to Access is a big thing. It's a good portion of our budget, and it's a way that if you want those supports, if you want that person to show up at 2 a.m., somebody's got to pay for it. And if you want us to pay the rent on the unit in Marshalltown, it makes a huge difference. And so that's what I like to focus on, is that's where you can have the greatest impact, is through a financial gift. We, of course, also keep on our website a wish list of smaller items, things like detergent and things like that, that help us with day-to-day operations. But the biggest thing, time and time again, you know, I can ask a survivor, you know, on our feedback surveys of what about our agency made an impact? It's always the services with staff involved. You know, mm-hmm. it's the time. It's, they needed somebody to safety plan and believe them when they were talking about how scary something is.
Right. Yeah.
They needed somebody to show up at the hospital with them. It's not that a gas card to get from place A to mm-hmm. place B wasn't helpful, because it super was. But when we talk about impact, we're talking about the people. And the people comes with a financial gift.
Yeah. So we'll put it in the show notes, but... Again, what is your website?
Oh, yeah. www.saltcarecenter.org. The www always feels funny to say. Yeah. I don't know if you're supposed to. But saltcarecenter.org is our website.
Great.
Okay, great. All right. So the last question, super important. What should we have for dinner tonight?
So before we got started, you talked about Thanksgiving. Do you still have sides left over?
I was going for the cop out.
No, I'm just kidding. No.
But we do have some leftovers.
Who likes to cook? That's where I think it's always nice when you've done a ton of cooking to reward yourself with not cooking. Mm-hmm. But if you don't, if you really feel ambitious, if you really, really feel ambitious, I'm always in chili mode when it comes to this cold weather.
Very good. Very good. What does chili mean to you?
Oh, chili. Despite my husband's, he doesn't like stewed tomatoes. So for me, the key to good chili is stewed tomatoes, but beans, meat, that sort of stuff all in there.
Very good. I think maybe we could pair up and each make separate chilies, because I'm with you on the stewed tomatoes and Mike is with your husband on the not stewed tomatoes. All right. Well, Tess, thank you so much for being here on the podcast, talking to us about Access. It's a difficult topic, but a really, really important one. And I feel like we both learned a lot here today, and hopefully our listeners did as well. So again, we'll put up the website in the show notes so people know how they can get involved and join us in supporting Access. For our listeners, if you are liking what you're hearing, make sure that you let us know. You can reach out to us and ask us if there are other nonprofits you want to hear from, if you have follow-up questions, anything like that. We're on Facebook, Bright Lights Big Data, on Twitter, at BLBDpod, and you can always email us, brightlightsbigdata@gmail.com. Otherwise...
So that's it for today. We'll have a couple more episodes in our nonprofit series for December. So looking forward to that. And this has been Bright Lights Big Data. We'll see you next time.